Hello and welcome to the Trans-Pacific Podcast. I'm Angela Schottenhammer from the History Department of KU Leuven. Today, I'm very glad to welcome my co-researcher, Dr. Mathieu Torck, to speak about a very important aspect of early modern seafaring, the vitamin C deficiency disease scurvy. In our last podcast, discussing the case of a late 16th century Spanish ship surgeon, Agustin Sanchez, we already touched upon scurvy, escorbuto in Spanish. In the early modern age, among the ailments that occurred during ocean-going voyages, scurvy was by far the most difficult one to tackle. It has a history that can be traced back to antiquity, but it was particularly with the onset of long-distance seafaring that the disease started to show itself. Scurvy developed after several months aboard ships on a low vitamin C diet and was characterized by a score of symptoms, among which the swollen, putrid gums and ulcerated limbs with teeth eventually falling out were the most notorious ones. We have recently found a brief, very interesting entry in a Spanish letter written by the Belgian-born Diego de Salcedo, Governor General of the Philippines in the 1660s, who reports about a horrible 8-month trip of a Spanish galleon crossing the Pacific from Luzon to Acapulco, causing more than 100 deaths due to scurvy. So, Mathieu, what kind of a disease is scurvy and how does it develop?
Scurvy belongs to the category of the malnutrition diseases which are provoked by a low intake of vital micronutrients such as proteins, minerals, or vitamins. Malnutrition may cause a variety of deficiency diseases such as osteoporosis, calcium deficiency, beriberi, thiamine deficiency, and pellagra, niacin deficiency. Scurvy is a form of malnutrition caused by a critically low intake of vitamin C, also known as L-ascorbic acid. It is not infectious nor contagious. Generally, the day-to-day depletion of vitamin C in the human body is about 3%, and this needs to be countered by a sufficient intake of vegetables, fruits, or other food products and beverages that are rich in ascorbic acid. Vitamin C is instrumental in iron absorption from vegetative foods and in the synthesis of collagen. Moreover, it supports the immune system in the protection from diseases. In order to keep the body in a healthy condition, it needs a regular intake of vitamin C. The current recommended daily allowance for vitamin C depends on age and sex. For adult women, it is 75 milligrams, and for adult men, 90 milligrams. If this intake is insufficient, a person will develop symptoms of scurvy. The first stage of the disease is characterized by general fatigue and painful limbs. In the course of several months on a vitamin C low diet, the patient's condition will further worsen with multiple symptoms like swollen and bleeding gums, loosening or loss of teeth, anemia, rashes, and hemorrhages in the lower extremities.
Was scurvy mainly a disease of poorly nourished early modern sailors?
Not quite. Scurvy surfaces in a wide variety of historical sources in the context of the onset of long-distance seafaring expeditions. But the disease naturally first occurred on land, and it would continue to do so even into modern times. As we may acknowledge in hindsight, vitamin C deficiency was common when food supplies started to deteriorate and the nutritional quality of diets degraded, particularly in the northern regions of Europe. Generally, scurvy developed when humans were in extreme conditions. Polar expeditions, in cities under siege, during protracted war campaigns, when the quality of rations suffered from neglect or supply lines failed altogether, or on board of ships.
How far can a disease like scurvy, historically speaking, be traced back?
As scurvy is a nutritional deficiency disease, we can hypothesize that it has been endemic in human societies since times immemorial. From the 16th century onward, surgeons systematically started to investigate the disease and its possible cures. One of the first to write a treatise on scurvy was the Dutch surgeon Johannes Echt in 1541. Just like many writers after him, Echt collected and drew upon historical references to scurvy in order to develop his ideas about the affliction. As knowledge circulated among medical specialists who studied at European schools of medicine in the Renaissance, Echt's historical survey was often copied, revised, and expanded. The first monograph that was exclusively devoted to scurvy was compiled by the Scottish naval surgeon James Lind in 1753. He also carried out the first clinical trials. Lind included a critical discussion of earlier surveys and descriptions of the disease since Echt. In retrospect, these early descriptions can now either be confirmed as scurvy, while others remain hard to identify as such. Traditionally, the oldest reference seems to be a hieroglyphic inscription from ancient Egypt. Moreover, a scurvy-like affliction befell some of the legions that operated in the northern part of the Roman Empire. And there is also a compelling description in the memoirs of Jean de Joinville of the Seventh Crusade around 1250.
Interesting. Can you perhaps tell us a little bit more about how difficult it is to identify scurvy in historical sources?
Naturally, the identification of a disease in historical documents by evaluating the symptoms is a highly complex matter. The data may be terse or incomplete, and moreover, one often has to deal with a medical framework which is steeped in Hippocratic and Galenic medical views, fundamentally different from present-day medical views. A lot of interpretation is needed. Besides, we should not forget that the symptoms of scurvy in its initial stages may be vague and easily to be misinterpreted. Some of the symptoms are quite similar to the ones that characterize certain other dental afflictions, such as periodontitis and gingivitis.
How can archaeology and paleopathology help to understand the historical occurrence of scurvy?
These disciplines allow us to obtain rare insights into scurvy pathologies in societies from a distant past, even from prehistorical times. As scurvy is known to leave traces on the bones of afflicted individuals even after centuries, an analysis of the skeleton may reveal the incidence of scurvy in these long-deceased patients. For example, endocranial lesions discovered in a child skeleton dating back to Bronze Age Britain have been linked to scurvy. And there are similar cases. For a more recent time frame, an investigation of skeletons of deceased scurvy patients, such as early modern whaling seamen, common sailors, or soldiers from battlefields, allows researchers to reconstruct the prevalence of the disease to some extent.
Has scurvy also a genetic dimension?
Yes. A few decades ago, microbiological and biochemical research focusing on deficiency diseases shed a whole new light on the disease and revealed that scurvy is a disorder that also has to be understood along genetic lines. Until an estimated 60 million years ago, the ancestors of humans were able to synthesize vitamin C simply by regular food intake. As most animals are still commonly able to do by means of the enzyme L-glucuronolactone oxidase. However, due to a mutation causing the inactivation of the enzyme, the distant ancestors of humans gradually lost the so-called endogenous vitamin C synthesis and depended on the specific ingestion of ascorbic acid through diet for their survival. But there's more. A further genetic differentiation occurred, which is called haptoglobin polymorphism. Haptoglobin is a hemoglobin-binding antioxidant. The distant ancestors of humans evolved into different groups with a varying proneness to scurvy. The result of this evolution is still visible today. There are three haptotypes, of which the so-called Hapto-1-1 type represents the strongest group in terms of vitamin C depletion. The HP2-1, a middle group, and the HP2-2 type, which features the fastest depletion of vitamin C. The proportion of these types among various populations of the world shows sharp differences. Generally, Native American and Pacific populations show the highest proportion of Hapto or HP1-1 types, while among Asians, the Hapto-2-2 type is more prevalent. Most African and European populations show a relatively balanced distribution of the three haptotypes. This genetic condition helps us to better understand historical mortalities due to scurvy, such as when comparing Asian and European long-distance seafaring experiences, or in the study of scurvy incidence among Celtic and non-Celtic populations in the context of the 19th century potato famine in northwestern Europe. Theoretically speaking, Asians are found to be more prone to develop scurvy, but this notwithstanding, due to different diets and high seas sailing practices, Asian sailors did not develop scurvy as frequently as Europeans.
Why did it take so long before a solution was found? We know that citrus fruits were effective in curing scurvy. Were there any early attempts to include, for example, lemons into sailors' daily diets?
It cannot be denied that poor provisions, a lack of a basic understanding of nutritional principles, and persistent ancient medical theories blurring the way towards a breakthrough were the main reasons for scurvy to linger. If you theorize that scurvy develops in relation with climatic conditions, such as the salty and humid environment of the sea, you are definitely a long way from finding a solution. Still, knowledge about safe sea voyages seems to have been available even in times before the age of sail. It is quite puzzling that a late medieval source like Gilbertus Anglicus Compendium Medicinae contains a short but detailed chapter with instructions for sea traveling. It specifically recommends to have fruits and vegetables, including salted vegetables, aboard ship. Apparently, the circulation of these principles did not materialize. Empirical trials with alleged antiscorbutic foodstuffs not seldom led to spectacular cures. But a curious aspect about the history of scurvy is that the integration of preventative measures in everyday seafaring practice was all too often too complex or expensive to arrange in a systematic way. Successful cures remained dead letter in a variety of accounts or were simply forgotten again. From early on, the impact of citrus fruits on the healing process of scurvy patients was recognized. Da Gama's 1498 voyage was the first oceanic sailing event during which scurvy was treated by means of administering oranges to the affected sailors. However, it remains unclear whether those oranges were part of a native cure among southeastern African coastal communities, or rather merely constituted a food gift that coincidentally happened to cure the scurvy-stricken sailors. Later, notable seafarers like Francis Drake, Richard Hawkins, and James Lancaster had noted the formidable benefits of citrus fruits as being most effective against scurvy. In his The Surgeon's Mate, the East India Company surgeon John Woodall was one of the first medical writers to advocate the method of including lemons into the diet of sailors. A stronger advice regarding lemons came from James Lind, whose trials constituted a milestone. But some of his ideas remained erratic and confusing and did not explain the true cause of scurvy. Cooking dozens of lemons into a thick lemon syrup, or ROP as it was called, considerably reduced the vitamin C content. Captain James Cook's experiments with anti-scorbutic foodstuffs on his voyages to the South Sea signified the next important step. Finally, it was the physician Gilbert Blane who managed to convince the British Admiralty to include lemon juice in the sailors' diet. The storage of citrus fruits and their differing vitamin C content were formidable obstacles that were not easily overcome in the early modern age.
What were the main circumstantial reasons of the occurrence of scurvy during long-distance ocean-going voyages?
Of course, malnutrition or poorly nutritious food supplies played a major role. But there are also secondary causes that helped trigger the occurrence of the disease. As we have noted, scurvy particularly cropped up with the onset of the age of sail, when sailing distances considerably expanded and blue water sailing by means of wooden sea craft became the order of the day. European nations expanded their horizons in search of financial gain. Scurvy could be kept at bay when there was a familiarity with sailing directions and routes. At the dawn of long-distance sailing, ships usually remained close to the coast through island hopping or harbor hopping. The problem with long-distance oceanic voyages was that navigators only had an approximate idea of where they were heading. This was especially the case when the aim of an oceanic voyage was exploration. But there were other factors involved. Heavy storms could dramatically change the position and the course of a ship. Another phenomenon that could jeopardize the health of ship's crews was to be caught up in the doldrums, a zone which is, in meteorological terms, coined the intertropical convergence zone. This is an equatorial zone where the northeast and southeast trade winds collide, leaving behind them a stretch of almost windless weather. In the age of sail, ships had a hard time escaping from it, especially on the long Trans-Pacific voyages. During his attempt to sail back to New Spain in May 1529, the ships of the Spanish navigator Alvaro de Saavedra Cerón were stuck in a windless zone for 43 days. During such a protracted stretch of time, without means to make progress, the quantity and the quality of the available provisions and the daily rations could come under stress. In 1602, the disease dealt a serious blow to an expedition from southern Mexico to California. The barefoot Carmelite friar, Father Antonio de la Ascension, who recounted the voyage, associated the ailment with the one that regularly besieged crews making the yearly passage of the Pacific from the Philippines. 60 years later, it took another Manila galleon a staggering 8 months instead of the usual 5 to 6 months to make the crossing. The result was a human disaster. As the manuscript documenting the voyage indicates, more than 100 out of 114 perished due to the mal de Luanda, one of several terms by which scurvy was known.
Could you elaborate perhaps also a little bit more on the socioeconomic aspects of shipboard diets and health in the context of scurvy?
Indeed, there is a dimension to the history of scurvy which at least in part explains its occurrence. One cannot deny that early modern maritime authorities lacked knowledge of basic nutritional principles, yet health and hygiene, including nutrition, were also determined by class. Among those infamous exploits in which scurvy played its sinister role, the Anson expedition from the 1740s stands out. It was targeted against the Spanish treasure ships, which sailed back and forth with precious cargoes between Manila and the Latin American ports. Anson's punitive expedition was ill-fated. Poor provisions, mainly consisting of hardtack and jerky beef, led to recurrent bouts of scurvy, resulting in heavy death tolls up to 70%, with the rest of the crew severely incapacitated due to scurvy. But the Anson disaster made another more indirect cause of the scurvy death toll painfully obvious. The health condition of the seamen recruited for the expedition had been poor in the first place. Many of them appeared to be weathered but invalidated sailors, which sharply increased the chance of the ailment to occur. On top of that, there were shocking differences in the quality of the foodstuffs that were provided on board. Negligence in the organization of food supplies, combined with the sheer fact that the quality of the food that common sailors received was often far inferior to the diet that was reserved for the higher staff and other upper-class members. Additionally, I would also mention economic gain. The purchase of good quality provisions weighed on the budget for fitting out an expedition. It was an expense that maritime authorities and sailing companies were only too eager to limit. It is therefore not too far-fetched to state that the fact that the disease, like scurvy, lingered on was at least in part due to profit-driven commercial enterprise. Moreover, the victualling of a ship was an area in which fraud and embezzlement frequently occurred.
So far, you refer to historical occurrences in Western maritime history. What do we know about the incident of scurvy beyond Western seafaring history?
At a first superficial glance at the bulk of historical sources documenting the occurrence of scurvy, one would indeed be inclined to think that the story of scurvy coincided with the age of sail voyages on the open ocean by means of wooden vessels. But that would be too narrow a point of view. Historically, scurvy, as well as other deficiency ailments, were always endemic in human communities struggling with food shortages or with monotonous diets. But the occurrence of the affliction did not always make its way into written documents. Indigenous knowledge about scurvy was present in many cultures, but from textual documentation, we only get glimpses of medical lore about scurvy. Local traders in the area where Vasco da Gama obtained the oranges that cured his scurvy-stricken crew may have been familiar with the beneficial qualities of the citrus fruits. The ships of the French sea captain Jacques Cartier got stuck in the ice while searching for a northwestern passage to China. His crew was fortunate to be rescued from disaster by members of the native population in the area of present-day Quebec, thanks to the application of indigenous medical practice. In the early 20th century, the Canadian Icelandic ethnologist Vilhjálmur Stefánsson lived on an Inuit-style diet for 5 years, mainly consisting of raw meat. The experiment proved that human populations who had no access to vegetables or fruit could adapt to an alternative diet and still remain scurvy-free.
What do we know about the historical occurrence of scurvy in China?
Indeed, the Chinese context allows for an interesting comparison. Chinese seafaring history developed along different lines. In spite of a long and rich tradition of maritime activities, and except for occasional large-scale naval operations, such as those commanded by Zheng He in the early Ming Dynasty, there is no Chinese chapter of long-distance ocean-going expeditions or intercontinental trade. Originally, Chinese ships did not venture too far from the coast. And even when sailing in the open sea became more common, the scope of the Chinese seafaring business was limited to the East and Southeast Asian maritime sphere. Sailing distances were limited, which considerably diminished the risk of developing scurvy. Nevertheless, the relevant sources reflect that diets aboard Chinese ships very commonly had a vegetable component in the form of salted cabbage. Although salting may considerably impact the vitamin C content of cabbage, it would still be sufficient to keep scurvy at bay. Moreover, Chinese sailors in the early modern age habitually consumed tea. This can be considered as a benefit. Biochemical analysis evidences that tea contains a small amount of vitamin C as well as phytates, biochemical substances that are instrumental in retaining vitamin C longer in the body as it inhibits iron absorption. However, all this does not mean that there was no scurvy in Chinese history. At the end of the 19th century, the German physician August Hirsch referred to regular occurrences of the disease in the Beijing area. But the most striking evidence of scurvy in China comes from an 18th century text. When the naval surgeon James Lind worked on his monograph concerning scurvy and carried out the first evidence-based trials testing antiscorbutic properties of foodstuffs, he could not have known that around the same time he had a counterpart in Qing Dynasty China. The medical compendium Yi Zong Jin Jian, the golden mirror of medicine, contains a compelling and very elaborate description of scurvy. Little is known about the precise circumstances, but a few important hints can be gleaned from the text. It refers to a Qing army surgeon, a certain Tao Qilin, who saw cases of scurvy among soldiers in the garrisons of the Northern Qing Army during the Yongzheng era, which is 1723 to 1735. He delivered a detailed account of his findings, obviously within the framework of traditional Chinese medical principles and experience. Most probably, it was Tao Qilin who coined what appears to be the earliest known term for scurvy in Chinese, namely Qing Tui Ya Gan, which translates as dark legs and gum inflammation. He related how the disease was common among Chinese who went to live in the border areas. Tao theorized that excessive meat consumption, lack of cereal consumption, and the cold and damp climate would be the main determinant factors in the development of this malady. What follows is a list of cures, basically medical decoctions, ointments, and other medical practices, such as bloodletting or the administering of horse milk and even horse brain to restore the body's condition. Finally, he also describes a number of incurable cases, which implies that Tao must have been confronted with incurable patients. The chapter on scurvy returns in later medical works in China. Also, we know that the book was exported to Japan and that some of the prescriptions from the passage on scurvy were at least once put into practice there to treat scurvy patients among troops in the area of Hokkaido in the early 19th century.
I really hope that we may find more texts in the future that may at least perhaps attest to scurvy, occurrence of scurvy in East Asia. Let us see. But how was scurvy eventually overcome, Mathieu?
As we have seen, until the end of the 18th century, the quest for a definitive solution was largely based on trial and error and conjecture about a possible connection with food intake. The medical framework did not allow for attempts to advance the development of a prophylactic line of thinking. Solutions had been around all the time and came tantalizingly close at hand, but physicians had a hard time grasping the essence of the ailment. In hindsight, this can at least in part be explained by the fact that scurvy was a non-infectious, non-contagious disease. This was befogging for early modern sailors and medical theorists, and it led them astray in their struggles to cope with the affliction. The long 19th century would still witness major outbreaks of scurvy, as during the Great Potato Famine in Northern Europe, the Gold Rush, and the Crimean War. And it was also often seen in children. However, major developments in medical science towards the end of the century led to the discovery that the human body needed certain micronutrients. The study of vitamins and of nutritional deficiency diseases was born and became a medical discipline. With the synthesis of ascorbic acid into crystals that could cure scurvy, pioneered by the Hungarian scientist Albert Szent-Györgyi in 1928, the disease ceased to be a life-threatening factor.
Does scurvy still occur in modern times?
Nowadays, scurvy can largely be considered as a disease of the past. But isolated cases do occur from time to time. Scurvy in its initial stages is sometimes diagnosed in the context of malnutrition, even in industrialized countries. Elderly people living in solitary locations may become negligent about their diets, as is the case for people whose diet shows very little variety or have developed a habit of heavy smoking, which has a destructive impact on vitamin C. A medical report from 2008 documents such an extreme case in Canada. The disease has also been noted in refugee camps where access to a stable diet is problematic, and AIDS patients may develop scurvy due to a health condition which is generally deteriorating.
Thank you very much, Mathieu, for these interesting insights. In the course of our Trans-Pacific project, we have identified various cases of outbreak of scurvy. We have here mentioned, for example, the case of a galleon that had crossed the Pacific and reached Acapulco in April 1661, with actually more than 100 people having passed away due to scurvy, El Mal de Luanda, and the remaining crew very sick. But the concrete identification of scurvy, as well as of medication and foodstuffs used to attempt to prevent or to cure the disease, remains an extremely difficult task. This was the Trans-Pacific Podcast, part of the ERC Advanced Grant, The Structure and Impact of Trans-Pacific Trade, 16th to 18th Centuries, the Manila Galleon Trade Beyond Silver and Silks.